some fab. Swear say them huge, but them just a lot. Some drop like leaf up on me.
90.3 FM, Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to No One's Legal Radio. We're part of the No Borders Media Network and CKUT News Collective's Off the Hour. We're 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca everywhere. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. We're back after several months hiatus. We're hoping to produce regular shows in 2022 and beyond, sharing and creating content in support of the struggles of oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. On today's show, we hear from three Ottawa social justice organizers and activists involved with grassroots responses to the far-right so-called Freedom Convoy, which occupied Ottawa for 3 weeks. On today's show, we hear excerpts from extended interviews with Debbie Owusu-Acha, Hassan Husseini, and Dan Sawyer. Debbie, a Black feminist queer, is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity, a resident of the neighborhood of Vanier, and is involved with police accountability and abolition efforts in the Ottawa area. Hassan Husseini is with the Public Service Alliance of Canada and Labour for Palestine, and is an Ottawa resident who helped organize the community protest against the convoy. Dan Sawyer is a member of the Punch Up Collective, which is an anarchist affinity group in Ottawa. He is a rank and file member of UNIFOR and a resident of the Centretown area. We start the show with a question for Debbie. Debbie, on this show, we're getting the impressions of various Ottawa community members and organizers, community organizers, social justice folks, about their impressions of the so-called Freedom Convoy that occupied your city for several weeks. It's been a while since that convoy is over, but of course, the debriefing and the repercussions are being discussed. Talk to our listeners, let our listeners know about how you experienced that convoy as an Ottawa resident. What were the things about it that bothered you? What were the things about the response, whether by the police, whether by the state, whether by the community, that either bothered you or inspired you? Give us a general sense of how that convoy was in terms of how you lived it and people you were close to lived it over those few weeks.
Right. Yeah, this is a great question. I think to explain my feelings about it, it kind of goes before the convoy actually arrived here in Ottawa. I often love using the phrase, there's this phrase or a meme that's been circulating around Black Twitter called Black Woman Tried to Tell You. And I say that because Black activists, Black queer women, have often been talking about the rise of white supremacy in this country forever. I remember there being a specific piece written by Janaya Khan, who is one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter Toronto, from 2017, that specifically called to the fact that this is happening in Canada, and often that messaging not being taken into consideration by those who need to hear it, which is the ruling class, decision makers, obviously because they benefit from white supremacy existing, and obviously from targeting other movements that they've always done. And so when I kind of contextualize it this way, because when there was conversations happening and we were seeing kind of clips from white, like right-wing white nationalists from like Facebook, Twitter, and other kind of media platforms like Telegram kind of speaking about this convoy and how many people were going to come to Ottawa, I knew the reality of it because we saw this before. Back in 2019, the United We Roll convoy came to Ottawa, and we had Yellow Vesta protests around the same time. And I remember when that happened, people didn't take it seriously, that there was a gathering of people who were connected to white nationalist movements in Canada, not too far from our homes. And I remember specifically telling people to be careful going downtown. I didn't see local media or local politicians in our city council kind of mention anything about the severity of it. But we as organizers were prepping community to be careful, because we know even if there's not a physical threat, the mere presence of those people, those organizations, still threatens our existence, because so much of the rhetoric is about people like us, queer, disabled, Black, brown, immigrant, et cetera, ceasing to exist, essentially. And so when this iteration of the convoy was coming here, I saw the same like nonchalant response from people. I even have friends from Brampton who are Black being like, ha ha ha, Debbie, you're gonna give us some like on the ground like scope of what's happening, right? And my response was like, it's not funny. It's not funny because this period that we're in the pandemic, this period that we're in just in history, I knew that that action that was about to come in this city was gonna be different. So when these folks did get here, and some of the things that we saw online from Ottawa Police Services, kind of essentially rolling out a red carpet for these folks, there was this graphic kind of mentioning how it's important to recognize the importance of protest, but we're gonna make sure we do our jobs, with an image of a truck. The tone of that was very much so like, this is a protest that we're cool with. We didn't see the same thing with other actions in this city, where they kind of were like, we have our eyes on this. It was very celebratory in tone. And I knew as soon as I saw that, the police were not going to respond to what was about to happen in this city the same way they responded to our actions that were, you know, less, I wouldn't say they weren't coordinated. They absolutely were, but not to the scale that we saw with this trucker convoy. And so I made the conscious decision that I was going to stay home. I don't live downtown, but I live in the neighborhood right next to it. I'm in the Vanier area, which is an area that is, I say mixed economy, but the part of Vanier that I'm in is the part that oftentimes people associate with being lower income, predominantly immigrant, predominantly poor, significant folks who are drug users. And, you know, it's a neighborhood that people like to ignore. And I bring that up for a very specific reason later on. But all this to say, I made the active decision not to attend. But when we saw what was happening downtown, we saw that these people were here, we saw the racist imagery, we saw the fact that many of the people who were coordinating this have said white supremacist things tied to things like the great replacement theory conspiracy, et cetera. I made it a conscious effort to kind of just tell people, you know, through whisper campaign, just be careful, don't go out there. And one of the things I found extremely frustrating when it went into maybe day 2, day 3 of the occupation was hearing other activists kind of talk about the fact that Ottawa wasn't doing anything, that somehow we just accepted our fate to be occupied by these fascists, when in actuality, it totally didn't consider the fact that Black people and queer people were organizing amongst ourselves in our own communication channels to protect each other. And, you know, I kind of tweeted this idea of like, you know, just because you don't see it being published on Twitter doesn't mean it's not happening. And to be completely honest with you, people were petrified. I know people who lived in Centertown who were scared to leave their home. I know people who live in Centertown who had to deal with the constant barrage of honking. And I mentioned, you know, even though if there's not a physical threat there, the mere presence of these people, that's scary. But then you add on top of it all these instances of harassment, all these instances of people wearing masks and, you know, being told certain things. And we saw attempts at arson. We saw attempts to lock condo buildings downtown. For me, it was extremely shocking to see all of this, but on top of it, the lack of response from our decision makers at the municipal level, plus the police. I think I was one of the first people in our community, alongside other Black and brown activists, to talk about that clear discrepancy and that clear racist hypocrisy, specifically with the mayor of the city, Jim Watson, who I am happy to call out. You know, not too long ago, a couple months ago, this man clearly talked about, you know, not, I respect protests, but I don't respect people who block infrastructure. Well, homie, what is happening downtown? And I remember sharing a specific clip from CBC where, kudos to that journalist, I don't give kudos to CBC a lot, but specifically spoke to the juxtaposition between the protests that happened, I believe in 2020, when Black and Indigenous folks shut down Laurier Street, versus this? And he had no answer. So I think what was shocking to me at the individual level, and I did deal with a lot of racial trauma at the time, was that I was seeing white Ottawans kind of finally get it, if that makes sense, finally recognize that this police institution that maybe they were like, oh, maybe if we don't do defunding, maybe we reform, maybe we look at policing to see what how it could be better, because they've obviously bought into the institution. I saw them finally get it to be like, holy shit, they actually don't care about us. And again, you know, that meme I talk about, Black women tried to tell you, we've been telling you this, that policing in this city, policing across this country, is not set up to help us. It's set up to protect capital. And that protest that they had that lovely image for, essentially welcoming them here and allowing these people to do things that we as Black and leftist organizers could never imagine, it's because it doesn't threaten them. It doesn't threaten what they speak for. It doesn't threaten what policing seeks to protect. I think when I saw that, I was dealing with a lot of, I guess, that feeling of being gaslit, because there's been so many times, especially now that I'm an executive director and I have to deal with the complexity of being someone who's the face of a national organization versus someone who's so connected to community, I've had to make the conscious decision of what protests that are out there to benefit the same, the people who look like me, that benefit the same people who are fighting for liberation. I have to choose the risk of my participation because I know the likelihood of arrest is very high for me as a Black person. But then I had to watch hundreds of white people get away with things that I could never imagine our movements being able to get away with. And I've always known this, but I think the constant reminder of it on social media and in mainstream media really reminded me that this world really fucking hates us. And I hope I can swear here. This world really fucking hates us. And it was a shocking reminder to me that, you know, after we, if this thing ever passes, and of course, now that we're talking about it, we know that the physical occupation is done, we're going to need to have a very serious conversation about what the nature of our organizing looks like when we know essentially we can be bold if we wanted to. Maybe we could test it. Maybe the fear of us getting arrested is something that, you know, these institutions like policing want us to do. It's the like psychological control they have of like, the threat of arrest is higher for you, therefore you're less likely to participate. I think that facade is gone now, I think. And so I think there's a different conversation we need to have about what does organizing even look like in Ottawa, kind of post this situation. You know, we're now dealing with an Ottawa police board where members of it were at the protest or donated. And so that's in shambles. And, you know, I think if there's any light at the end of the tunnel, it's I think people who would have never been on the other side, who were not radicalized enough to recognize that policing is something that we could defund, and I would even say boldly something that we could abolish. I think some of these people who were centrist are getting it. And I think that's something that we can take advantage of. We can like mobilize around that. But then I think for Black and Indigenous activists who've had to deal with the psychological trauma of seeing the images of the police supporting fascist white supremacist movements, I think there's a conversation we need to have about amongst ourselves of what does risk mean when we do actions like this? What does our organizing look like now that we've everybody's seen the thing that we've been talking about for so long? We can't let people forget that this is something that happened. And I think that's something I've been really, really thinking about. To add to it as well, and I mentioned the fact that I live in Vanier, I love my comrades who live in Centertown, but I think oftentimes the overwhelming whiteness of leftist movements sometimes and those who live in Centertown, we often forget that just because we can push out these truckers from our own like periphery, we need to realize where are we pushing them to? There were so many activists who were, again, lower income, were racialized to live in Vanier. who had to specifically speak about the fact that these truckers built a base camp in our neighborhood, and we weren't seeing, you know, city councilors, we weren't seeing journalists originally kind of talking about this or giving it the same attention that they were giving Centertown. Again, I bring it back to the fact of that proximity and the fear that it meant. You know, it took a while, and I want to give kudos to, you know, I won't say their name, but there's one individual who put, you know, his life on the line as a brown man constantly going to scope out and tell community, hey, they're here, be careful, definitely taking pictures and like detailing on maps where they are so that people knew what where to avoid. You know, there was a journalist who's involved with mainstream media who actively made sure to cover, you know, that base camp on Coventry. So that narrative of like, they're also here in a neighborhood that people don't really think about because it's not where Parliament Hill is. It's where poor people live. You know, they constantly made sure that people knew that this was happening. And so, you know, again, calling out the hypocrisy about the response there, about what wards or what regions in Ottawa matter more than others. I basically say this to say that it was an exhausting process emotionally. I felt like living in Ottawa during this time, when this was happening, seeing the responses to it, the racist hypocrisy at all levels, you know, being frustrated, I think, with activists and their response, but also recognizing the fact that a lot of us was afraid. It was a really emotional period for me as a Black queer woman. But I think now, you know, now that we're kind of emerging from this convoy, there's some important conversations to be had. And I'm really craving, and, you know, I'm also brainstorming myself, how can we create those spaces? How can we have these conversations? Because I don't think it's over just because they're physically not here. We have just been reminded that these white supremacist movements are bold, well-coordinated, well-funded. Frankly, they've been able to accomplish things that our movements could only dream of. Like, could you imagine being able to shut down infrastructure for, you know, addressing issues like missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, or addressing things like police brutality? These are the things that we would love to see. Now we can have conversations about what that looks like. We can have conversations about the need to specifically mention white supremacy when we talk about anti-hate movements in this country, and not be afraid to name white supremacy as that, and then to really think about building solidarity to address it, because if we don't, we're going to be dealing with something far more scary than a bunch of truckers occupying downtown Ottawa.
You're listening to No One's Legal Radio. We are part of the No Borders Media Network and CKUT News Collective's Off the Hour. We're at 90.3 FM in Montreal and www.ckut.ca everywhere. Today's show hears from social justice activists and organizers based in Ottawa who were involved with grassroots responses against the so-called Freedom Convoy that occupied Ottawa. Our next question is for Hassan Husseini of the Public Service Alliance of Canada, who helped organize the community protest against the convoy. Let's get into the organizing slash counter-organizing to the far-right Freedom Convoy that you were involved with. My understanding is this constituted both a community march, a family-friendly community march that happened on a Saturday, roughly 2 weeks into the occupation, followed by a very inspiring morning of and a day of blockades. Now, as a prelude to this question, I want to mention that, you know, and you've already alluded to this, this was a surprise, but this also isn't easy under any circumstances, because first of all, this implies having a coherent organizing community, which isn't always the case. You know, there's the usual problems that any organizing community will have, from, you know, from burnout to disagreements to, you know, just divergences on tactics and strategy. Obviously, there was a lot of concerns about the risk factor involved with the violence potentially, you know, and when we're talking about the far right, this does include, you know, people associated with movements like Canada First, former Proud Boys, people like that, that, you know, that crave being involved in violent confrontations. And of course, Ottawa is a progressive city, but Ottawa is also, you know, the capital. It's, I guess, maybe a little different than, say, Montreal in terms of your starting point. So I mention all that because I was in conversation with a lot of organizers, and my whole point was, I know it's not easy, and I really admire anything that anyone pulls off. That was my point. My point was, like, even if it's something small, do what you can, because there's no template here. And you add to all of this, of course, the pandemic and the fact that our side of the equation, while we are critical of government responses, you know, we do take public health seriously. So it's not going to be, you know, something we just jump into. So I wanted to give that whole prelude, because I know those were a whole bunch of factors going into how to respond, when to respond. Maybe it could have been earlier. You know, maybe even what you did do was being second-guessed by some folks. So talk about getting to that point within 2 weeks of being ready to take the streets with the family-friendly demo. And maybe after that, we can talk about the blockade, which obviously probably had its own dynamic as well.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, I wish we were able to organize earlier. It really did take us 2 weeks before we got going, because in some respects, and this speaks to the weakness of the left, generally, it speaks to the weakness of the labor movement. It speaks to the division that exists within the labor movement. Specifically, over the past 2 years, you've those weaknesses were highlighted by the vaccine policy and the vaccine mandates and so on. And so a lot of labor unions who are not very activist oriented to begin with, and you know that the whole problem we have within the labor movement. But added to that, the internal problems that they were facing as a result of the pandemic meant that for 2 weeks we didn't see any initiatives to try to organize anything. In fact, most of the opposition was on an individual level by residents themselves, who are not really organizers, but they were fed up with what's happening in the city, and they started to engage in some legal strategies to try to work with lawyers to have some injunctions against noise and pollution and so on and so forth. But the left, unfortunately, as I said earlier, we were not prepared. Add to that the weakness that we have meant that we didn't get off to organizing until 2 weeks after. And even then, there was an attempt before the big demonstration that we organized the week before. There was an attempt to organize something that's close to the convoy. And there was a lot of division and a lot of fear, and a lot of people didn't feel that they could participate in a demonstration that was so close to the extreme right organizers of the convoy, for fear of the violence, knowing who they are and the fact that they've engaged in violence in previous instances. So that's why the previous attempt was weak and divided and didn't engage as well as it should have. And that was the week before we organized the first more safety-oriented rally, if you will, family-friendly rally in a neighborhood that is a little bit far from where the convoy is entrenched. And that didn't happen until a number of activists stepped in, organized and brought together the labor movement as well as community activists to give some legitimacy, if you will, to some of the action. And we really worked on the question of safety a lot because of those concerns that we saw the week before. And I can say that a lot of us perhaps thought and were counting on some established organizations such as the Labor Council to step up. They didn't. And ultimately, I think the Public Service Alliance of Canada, through its local leadership, stepped up, and both in terms of activists, in terms of resources, helped and worked very closely with other labor activists and with the community folks to pull off the first very successful action that you may have seen on social media. And we believe that that actually broke the fear that a lot of people felt about engaging in something that was so public. And I believe that happened the next day on February 13th with the blockades in various parts of the city was in some respect informed by this this breaking of the fear that that was established the day before. So yes, that's where we ended up, and I think that our work is cut out for us going forward in terms of organizing in the city against the far right, both coming from outside the city and those that are within the city itself.
Before we get into the blockade that took place on February 13th, the day after the community demonstration, and the day before the invocation of the Emergencies Act by the Trudeau government, which obviously our side wasn't responsible for, and most of which does not support it. Before getting into that, you used the phrase about breaking fear. That one of the positive outcomes of that protest was to break the fear of being able to take the streets in the context of this far right convoy. And I've said in many times in other podcasts and talking to different organizers in different contexts that, you know, a first step towards any organizing is breaking isolation and breaking fear. If you address those things, then you're on the steps towards building something. Because if you're isolated, you can't. And if you're scared, you can't. So can you talk about that a bit more? Like, what did that look like? How did that feel? Are there any anecdotes you can share about the breaking of fear vis-a-vis this convoy that happened on February 12th in Ottawa?
Well, I think when we had the a number of meetings before the rally itself, a number of activists came forward and expressed, especially activists who come from racialized communities, who have had experiences with some of the organizers on the far right. They know how dangerous they are. And they know that the police are not there to protect us. In fact, if it comes to it, the police are on their side, and we will be at the negative receiving end of any police action, as opposed to the far right white supremacists. They expressed a great deal of fear and wanted to make sure that we have safety mechanisms and tools in place to allow us to pull off a successful event that demonstrate the strength of the community and the anger that's building within the community, not only against the extreme right that organized the convoy, but also at the municipal, provincial, federal political leaderships that have failed us at every level, which is predictable considering that they've been failing us with their austerity measures and the neoliberal agenda and so on. But at this very important juncture, they felt that their own safety, the police and the city officials and provincial and federal officials, they were not interested in even maintaining or helping them. So we had to, when we organized this event, we, first of all, we had to change the route once, because we also faced opposition that emanated from fear, from local politicians, both municipal as well as provincial, that we support you, we support what you're doing, but you got to be careful not to go to certain neighborhoods and communities because we fear what may happen after you leave in terms of the backlash against residents in those communities. And we had a lot of discussions with them, and it wasn't until the last hour, essentially, the day before the rally, that we actually changed the route and steered away from going close to the center town area that is close to where the convoy is. So we faced a great deal of that fear, and I can tell you that it was not, at times very unhelpful in terms of our exchanges that we had with some of the elected leaders, because they heightened that fear that, in my view, was, yes, it's important to take into account and into consideration, but it was not helpful on their part. Needless to say, in order to pull off that successful rally that we had first, we had to have a great deal of elements in place, the marshals and a safety plan and an alternate route and a legal team and lawyers on standby and a medical team and legal observers. All of them were part of the demonstration to make sure that if we are targeted by either the police or, of course, the extreme right, that we have the organization to be able to handle that. That kind of helped to alleviate some of the fear of some of the people who were concerned at the beginning. And once that was pulled off successfully, I think that's when the fear was broken and we moved to the next stage of organizing in the city.
Well, you went from changing demo routes to accommodate, you know, whether legitimate or maybe exaggerated fears that people have, to waking up the next morning and blockading cars and vans of people who are trying to participate in the Freedom Convoy. So that was quite the switch up. And I know there was inspiring stuff happening across Canada, wherever these Freedom Convoys were having their support demos. For example, in Vancouver, people on bikes and others prevented trucks from getting into the city center. In Winnipeg, people were blockading. But you know, that was very inspiring to hear about. So talk about that. I've sort of left the most, at least for me, at least one of the most interesting parts of what happened in terms of the progressive response to the end of this interview. But that is on Sunday, February 13th, that morning, when in a variety of locations in one part of Ottawa, you were blocking cars and trucks that were trying to participate, and they were eventually turned away. And this lasted over several hours and was, on some levels, it seemed like the best kind of organizing. On some levels, it seemed really organized. On other levels, it seemed really spontaneous. So talk about what happened on February 13th.
Well, the next morning, yes, we got, I wasn't one of the organizers of the Saturday blockades. I received a call from comrades to say, are you interested in participating? And rounded up a good group of folks to initiate a blockade the next morning, that Sunday morning at 9 o'clock at one of the locations. When we got to that location, we were told that there were two other blockades that were independently organized by two different groups. One of them that was on Riverside and Bank Street near the area called Billings Bridge, that was organized by a group of neighborhood dog walkers, and so we were part of that at the beginning, and that particular area, Billings Bridge blockade, happened first. And so those cars and trucks that were heading downtown towards where we were didn't get there because they had blocked them earlier. So all the activists moved to the Billings Bridge area. We arrived there around 9:15, 9:20. At that time, there were probably around maybe 40, 50 people. We were supposed to be there for a couple of hours just to delay them. And we ended up being there 10 hours, Jaggi. Okay. And the numbers grew from about 40, 50 to, I would say, probably there were 1,000 people out there at different times of the day. That was spontaneous organizing. And I can tell you, people, when I say the fear was broken the day before, absolutely that was the case. And people came in the second day, they were angry. They were pissed off. They were left activists and labor activists who are, battle hardened, if you will, and we pride ourselves on being radical and so on. But I can tell you, when we were out there on the blockade, we had to talk some people down from wanting to not let these people leave at all with their cars and let them walk back to their base camp, and we're going to take their cars and so on. So a lot of us ended up actually organizing democratic discussions to see exactly what we wanted to do with the blockade as the clock ticked on, right? And we needed to do something, and we needed to come out from that particular blockade with something tangible and inspiring that we can hopefully propel us to the next step in terms of our organizing in the city of Ottawa. And we worked hard to arrive at that. And I can tell you, it was absolutely exhilarating. It was absolutely inspiring to see community folks and labor activists coming together, engaging in democratic discussions about what should be done. And ultimately, what we ended up deciding on is that those folks who are there, if they want to leave, that's on the end of the day after 10 hours, first they have to surrender their flags. Some of them were pretty offensive flags, as you can imagine. They have to surrender their jerry cans full of fuel that they were taking downtown, which the police refused to do, but we ended up actually accomplishing that. And in some cases, some of them had to scrape from their windows some of the decals that were also far right and had the messages in support of the convoy and the so-called freedom convoy and so on. But it was all done to some extent, of course, in a spontaneous fashion. And it was organized on the ground, and it was really great manifestation of when the community rises up to fight back on its own. And I can tell you the police at that point also played a role that that was not, well, I mean, was helpful in the sense that they didn't, you know, use a heavy hand with us. But at the same time, there were elements that came halfway through the day from the convoy who were certainly aggressive, tried to taunt, tried to pick fights. We were told by some of the cops that there are warrants for their arrests, but yet none of them were arrested at that particular time. As far as I know, they may not have gotten arrested even afterwards. All this to say, including Pat King, who showed up and tried to rally the troops to attack us, and he ended up coming down there with four or five of his goons. Needless to say, I think that was incredibly successful and incredibly motivating for members of the community that we cannot rely on anybody but ourselves in organizing against the far right. And that was a great takeaway for all of us. And I think that's what's right now keeping us going, frankly, in terms of organizing the city of Ottawa to continue to confront the far right, both within the city and those who are coming from outside.
You're listening to No One's Legal Radio. We are part of the No Borders Media Network and CKUT News Collective's Off the Hour. We're at 90.3 FM in Montreal and www.ckut.ca everywhere. Today's show hears from Ottawa social justice organizers and activists involved with grassroots responses against the far-right so-called Freedom Convoy that occupied Ottawa. Dan Sawyer is a member of the Punch Up Collective, an anarchist affinity group in Ottawa. He's a rank-and-file member of UNIFOR and a resident of the Centretown area of Ottawa. Our next questions are for him. Dan, before you go on to the community rally, I wanted to just ask you a question because I remember chatting with you a few days before that February 5th thing. And you sort of exclaimed, I forget if it was in a text or something, but you kind of exclaimed, this is like the debates we had back in the late 90s and early 2000s. So maybe can you suss that out a bit? Because obviously a lot happened since then, right? I mean, from February 5th to February 13th, you know, you go from a feeling of despondency and what the hell, you know, we're 20 years behind the curve to, wow, we got 1,000 people out to blockade this and we're doing direct action. So, but go. I mean, that happened literally in a week. In the beginning of that week, you know, like February 4th and 3rd, I got the sense that you were exasperated by some of those debates. So talk about what some of those debates were, because I think a lot of listeners, I mean, maybe not a lot of listeners, but some listeners can identify with some of those debates that happened in their own communities. What were those debates like? How were they framed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think like we were all struggling at that point to figure out what an appropriate response would be, right? So there was a lot of frustration and fear and anger about what to do and how did we even let this happen to us in the first place? Like, why weren't we better prepared for this? And so we were all struggling to figure it out. But there were these conversations around the response that did to me feel a lot like early 2000s diversity of tactics conversations, because they revolve around, in some ways, these really abstracted ideas about risk. So is doing anything going to put people at risk? Who's it going to put at risk? What are the risk levels? Those sort of abstract conversations about risk, as opposed to more tangible, like, well, what are our options for action? And, you know, like on that spectrum of options for action, what works for the people we're trying to get out into the street? And So it really did feel like that. And people were openly, not to name names, but people were openly referencing those early 2000s discussions, particularly in Ottawa. You know, people were, you know, subtweeting about, you know, having, you know, flashbacks to DOT discussions in the early 2000s and stuff like that. And it did feel a lot like that to me. But it was, you know, but I think people were just really like, honestly, just didn't know how to respond. And honestly, at that point, and I think that's part of the reason February 5th was so important, that small rally, because it, you know, there was a sense that people in Ottawa opposed the occupation, but we didn't really know how widespread it was, right? We didn't really know if we called for something, how many people were going to come out, what they were going to be prepared to do, right? So I think there was just a lot of uncertainty around it that fed these sort of very vague, to me, vague discussions about risk. It's important to talk about risk. Obviously, different people have different risk levels and can be targeted in different ways and all that kind of stuff. But when the conversation gets a bit abstract, I think it can really bog down organizing. And I think that's what was happening in the early part of February.
And before you continue, as part of the Punch Up Collective, you folks, I mean, you've released a few statements that have been quite useful, but you released one, I think, around February 5th. So, you know, at the height of this. So what went into that? What were some of the discussions? I mean, you're a small collective, so you're able to talk about things. What went into that statement? What did you feel was important to put out there? I'll let people know that, you know, they can check out the Punch Up Collective website. It's punchupcollective.org. And, you know, you have two or three statements up there that relate to the occupation. People can read it in full, but talk about putting that out. I mean, in it, you address the three-way fight, which we've talked about on this show before. Talk about that statement and getting that out on February 5th.
Yeah, well, I think we put it up for a couple of reasons. Like, one, because we really wanted, number one, we wanted to support the mutual aid stuff that was happening. It was essential and needed and fantastic. And some of us were directly involved in it in different ways. So we wanted to support that and affirm that work. But we also really wanted to stress that we didn't think mutual aid was going to be enough to get the occupation out of Ottawa and to help us get ready for next time. That there needed to be some community-based public opposition. And so I think that's the core of what we wanted to get out there and support moving from mutual aid or staying with mutual aid, but also building to some other stuff. And that's sort of what we really wanted to stress. And I think a lot of people were moving in that direction we just wanted to contribute our little thoughts on that. So then basically February 5th broke the ice, and then there was labor and some community groups called for a meeting to plan a community opposition. And so a march was planned, and it was deliberately like geographically kept away from the convoy. So the risk levels were low and people knew going into it what the risk levels would be. We also did a lot of work to make sure, you know, there was lots of infrastructure in place to support people in the demonstrations. You know, there was a full legal setup. There were marshals of various kinds. There was, you know, it was very well structured. So people going knew what they were going to get in for and could make the appropriate choices for themselves. And it was great. It was easily 4,000 people. It felt very affirming. It really was a moment that affirmed for a lot of us just how widespread and broad-based the opposition was, how many people were willing to come out. And definitely the vibe in that march was, for me anyway, was this march is great, but what's next? Like, and maybe next time we could go a little closer to the occupation, because we really kept ourselves geographically distant. But you know, there were some pretty magical moments on that. Like, I mean, some of us were a little let down that we at one point left some major streets, for example, and marched through a residential neighborhood. And the decision was that the march should, you know, we shouldn't be chanting because people have been, you know, exposed to too much noise lately because of the horns. And that was a weird dynamic for some of us at first. But so many people came out of their homes or opened their windows to cheer or brought their kids out or joined the march as we went through residential neighborhoods. It was a tremendously affirming moment. And at the end of that march, people really were immediately wanted to talk about what to do next. And no one really knew at that point. But later that night, some of us noticed that that there was a convoy planned for the next day to resupply the people downtown that was coming in from two separate directions, one from the east and one from the west, and they published their routes online on Facebook. And so immediately these independent conversations happened. It wasn't until the next day we realized several people had all been thinking and planning this. So that night, these sort of four, possibly five, independent autonomous blockades targeting those two convoys launched at pretty much the same time, about 9 a.m. Sunday, February 13th. And they started really small. The one that we helped organize, there was probably about 25 or 30 of us. There were two other ones at that point, and another one went up later in the day. All autonomous, spontaneously organized on the fly. We all ended up more or less gravitating to one that was at Bank in Riverside, which is a real choke point. Trucks coming down Riverside, if you block them right by a bridge there, they're basically stuck in place. They can't go back, they can't turn, they're just stuck. And so we all gravitated to there. And when we first got there, it was small. There was maybe 40, 50 people at that point, 60 people. But it grew so fast, easily more than 1,000 people at the high point, probably more than that, because a lot of people came in and out. And we basically trapped trucks on that street, 30 or 40 trucks, for about eight and a half hours. And they were only allowed to leave one at a time if they let us take their flags, scrape off any decals they had on their trucks, and search their vehicles for fuel. And we would seize any fuel they had on them, so they couldn't take them with them. It was tremendously successful. And people were absolutely into it, and wanted to do more of it. There was another blockade, which I do want to mention because it doesn't get a lot of attention, but there was one downtown, the sort of choke point as well, that happened down by the police station. A convoy coming in from the west was stopped there by a crew of about 12 or 15 people, and it got pretty rough. At one point, a truck hit one of the people blocking the street. She's okay, but she was knocked down. The police ended up intervening and shutting that blockade down and letting the trucks through. But about less than an hour later, that blockade went back up. People put it right back up again as soon as the cops had left, which is pretty great. So we were all really, really happy with how Sunday went. And it really felt like that whole weekend felt like a massive turning point for Ottawa, that like this was something that we could collectively confront.
You're listening to No One's Legal Radio. We're part of the No Borders Media Network and CKUT News Collective's Off the Hour. We're at 90.3 FM in Montreal and www.ckut.ca everywhere. Today's show hears from Ottawa area social justice organizers and activists involved with grassroots responses against the far-right so-called Freedom Convoy that occupied Ottawa. We wrap up our show with some final insights from Debbie Owusu-Acha, resident of the Vanier neighborhood and a Black feminist queer community organizer. It seems that one of the insidious things about this is that police forces, whether the Ottawa Police Force, RCMP, or police forces across the country, are going to use what happened with the convoy to justify trying to getting more money for their own budgets. It's just simply insidious. Debbie, as a last question, and you've basically been alluding to this in different ways in your various responses, I just want you to talk about going forward and the lessons in as much as we can determine lessons at this stage, because it's still pretty raw. That's the impression I get. From talking to organizers, this only happened, it's only been over for about 2 weeks, and it's not really over. Nothing's over when it's that intense, and especially in terms of harassment and the attack basically on community members. So if you can just talk about what it's like going forward in terms of how people are going to be debriefing, some of the lessons that people are trying to get from this, the good things that came out of it, maybe the not so good stuff beyond the police and the city response, just as a way of wrapping up the interview and your reflections on the so-called Freedom Convoy.
I think the debriefing part is so, so important and critical at this moment. I think based off my assessment, there's like that vibe where people are still in recovery mode. We're still, I think, individually processing what the heck happened. And I think immediately, especially those of us in Ottawa, dealing with the like quick whiplash to what could possibly be a large-scale war that our country is funding and wants to participate in for a variety of reasons. And so I think a lot of people are dealing with the recovery of what happened with the trucker convoy, plus what continues to feel like a bombardment of crises over crises, and are like, where do we even go with this pivot? But I think what most people are doing, and I think those of us who are able to kind of help facilitate are really trying to do so in a way that's really caring, is really start to slowly have these debriefing conversations, these like moments where we can really talk about what really happened and where do we go from here. You know, I've been fortunate enough, I think, now to feel really comfortable to leave my home and to go to spaces where other leftist activists are talking about what happened and are reminding ourselves about the beauty of our organizing and our response to it. You know, I specifically made a call out to remind people, especially with how we were seeing the narrative shift post the Emergencies Act and the physical removal of truckers, that I basically told people, remember that frustration and anger at the lack of response from Ottawa City Ottawa and the police? Please don't lose that, because power likes comfort. If you're comfortable, power benefits. If they're comfortable, power benefits. And so we really need to use the emotions and the frustration and organize around it. And so I feel like what we're going to see are more moments of those conversations happen in February 2022. Yeah, as a result of it, we need to prepare for X, Y, and Z. I know that this Saturday, there's a rally in March that's happening, that's being co-led by a series of Ottawa-based groups and unions. That's something that I'll be participating in. What I like to do is kind of take those lessons and really contextualize them in a culturally affirming way, so that Black folks and other folks who might not attend these because they think it's really white can understand like what's on the horizon. You know, it's an election year here in Ottawa and also provincially. And so really reminding people, because those tend to be very easy ways to get people to organize, that those are two periods that we can organize around. We can organize around the provincial election. I think often what was missing in the discourse is the responsibility the province had and what they didn't do, because the Emergency Act didn't have to happen. There were actually powers within the province to respond to it, but we know who's in cahoots with who. And then there's the municipal election, which I think for this city, and we're talking about municipalities so differently now, is that this is something that we can really impact, and it's equally as important. This convoy just showed us why we really need to make sure we have the right people and the right ideas that are at the forefront of, you know, what City Hall is doing. So there's the conversations, there's the reminder, I think there's the healing. There's been several healing spaces that have been happening too, some of them being BIPOC-led, which has been beautiful to see. These things all need to happen at the same time, in order for us to have a proper debrief, but then also to like prepare ourselves for what's going to happen next. I think outside of the Ottawa context, I really think for people who are committed to leftist movements and to liberation and fighting against oppression across the country, we really need to talk about what are we going to do to, you know, be ready to respond to what is now an emboldened white supremacist movement that has money, that recruited people. Like, let's be honest, those people who donated $20, who did it because they're really frustrated about wearing a mask, they were so easily brought into something that they didn't necessarily associate to a white supremacist movement, but the response to it could have now further radicalized them on the other side, because the left didn't really do anything to really mobilize around the frustrations around the pandemic. And I think there's been other activists who've been talking about that for so long. I think we really need to have a serious conversation about how are we responding to white supremacy in this country? How are we responding to white supremacy on top of other hate? Because anti-LGBTQ hate, anti-trans hate is connected and oftentimes an entry point for people to get radicalized on white nationalist movements. We need to really talk about it, and it can't just be this like theoretical thing that we leave to Black activists to write articles about. No, we need a coordinated response. We need to see unions involved. We need to see the student movement involved. We need to see grassroots organizations. We need to see rad folks who are in whatever position that they're in working together against this, because it's going to be big. And I think those moments of joy that we saw, those moments of bravery we saw amongst other like rad people during the convoy, those should be the things that inspire us to know that like we can do this, we can respond to this, and we can do so really, really well. And it has to be something we see across the country. And so, yeah, I think in terms of like where we're going next, it involves so many different things at the same time. It has to be local, but it also has to be broader than that as well.
That wraps up the March 22 edition of No One's Illegal Radio. No One's Illegal Radio is part of the No Borders Media Network and CKUT News Collective's Off the Hour. We're at 90.3 FM in Montreal and www.ckut.ca everywhere. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. Thank you to everyone who supported today's show, including Debbie, Hassan, Dan, as well as Jack at CKUT. For the full interviews with today's guests, as well as our previous episodes and podcasts, check out the No Borders Media SoundCloud or our social media accounts on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. No One's Legal Radio, part of the No Borders Media Network, highlights the struggles of communities and resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working class people of color. We share and create content in support of the struggles of the oppressed and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism, as well as the racist far right. Stay tuned for Upstage.
it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from dramas to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chauchage, Mooneyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. We start this evening's show looking back on an illustrious career with an established Montreal director who's been doing cutting-edge work, what her next step is going to be. And we also finish the show with two emerging choreographers, both of them very excited to finally present their respective new shows, and oddly enough, both creations rely on collaboration and textiles. Tonight is all about the ties that bind. My guest tonight, Micheline Chevrier, steps away from the top job at Imago Theatre after 9 years in the role.
Theatre for me is one of the few places where we can share stories that actually shape our lives. They shape the way we think, and therefore they shape the way we act and how we shape the world, ultimately. And I do believe theatre can change the world. I do believe art can change the world. So yeah, it just seemed to be a natural fit. And of course, like everybody, has started as an actor, but directing to me quickly became the passion for me for the rest of my career.
Multidisciplinary queer artist Sydney McManus on her collaborative work with Jean Bouy. They fold shirts and blur boundaries.